Welcome to the Skits and Giggles podcast. I'm Pascal, the chief instigator of this show and your host. I'm joined by our resident engineer and the yin to my yang, the dumb to my dumber, my co-host Bryson. Bryson, how's it going today?
Hey Pascal, doing great. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And I'm very excited to finally say the words. Hey guys, this is episode one of the Skits and Giggles podcast. It feels very good, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
We've obviously been working on this project for some time, just, dialing in our setup and dealing with a few hiccups along the way. But we're here now, and I'm also stoked that we can kick off our show with a great first guest and a discussion on what it takes to run a business in the bike industry in 2021, which I think is very topical at the minute and should provide some good insights into what lies ahead for everyone that is keen to get out on their bikes in the next few weeks and months. But before we jump into the conversation with James, I want to take some time and maybe talk a little bit about what we want to achieve with the Skits and Giggles podcast. So Bryson, maybe to start with, why do you want to start another mountain bike podcast?
Well, it was only natural, as we're both avid listeners of podcasts and also of mountain bike podcasts, of which there's plenty of great content covering headlines and the new stuff and writing tips. However, we both agreed that there is nothing out there that explores all the little stories, perspectives, and people that make mountain bike so great. And on top of that, we also wanted to bring in the local flavor of mountain biking here in Switzerland, which in itself deserves much more attention. And that's also what we're trying to do. We're trying to do that with an interesting take. And Pascal, what convinced you to take the Skits and Giggles mantra and make it into a podcast?
Well, the Skits and Giggles mantra, if you will, started already a couple of years ago, after a great weekend trip to the mountains. And I just thought it was a fitting theme at the time to describe what I like most about mountain biking. And that's basically just goofing off in the mountains with your buddies, hooting and hollering and having a good time. And of course, pulling skids and just having a laugh. At first, it was just a funny design and some stickers. And then people started liking those stickers, and there was a lot more stickers, and there was a water bottle, and we now all sold out of the water bottle. So it felt like a natural progression to make it into a podcast. And as you say, I mean, I think it's a very interesting time to talk about mountain biking. If there's one positive thing coming out of the pandemic, then it's that more people than ever are getting out on their bikes, be it as new riders or as riders that are rediscovering their love for the bike as a simple means of getting out of the house and having some fun. I also believe that the two of us, we can provide an interesting perspective on both Switzerland as well as on riding an actual bike. With you hailing from the promised land of mountain biking, BC, Canada, and having lived here for a number of years now. I'm Swiss from the German-speaking part, so I have a slightly easier access to the local community in terms of the language. But I have also spent most of my adult life living abroad and away from my hometown. We both have been riding since we were little kids, and I personally have spent the last 25 years racing bikes in pretty much every discipline that is out there. You now work in the bike industry, you have some coaching experience, and as an engineer, you clearly have a slightly different perspective on things as I do as a simple consumer. Lastly, there's a few topics that I would like to explore more for me personally and educate myself on. Me and my family, we are currently at an interesting crossroads in terms of bikes, with our kids just entering that age where the bike could become more than just a mode of transport. And that's obviously a topic I want to explore some more.
Well, it's great, Pascal, but we didn't have to start a podcast in order for you to tell me how you feel about bikes. However, I am interested to learn more.
Right on. Enough of the introduction and our plans for the future. Let's just talk a little bit about our guest and the main takeaways from the conversation. Bryson, what did you think?
Yeah, first off, I'm really happy that we had James on the podcast. He is a writing buddy of ours and a good friend. And I found it very interesting to hear his take on the challenge that he faced running a business in the bike industry in 2020 and what it will mean for 2021. Pascal, what about you? How did you feel about the conversation?
Well, I was, the main surprise for me was this whole theme of customization. I wasn't quite clear that this is such a big thing. Although now that I've thought about it some more, I have to say that, you know, whenever I buy a new bike, then, you know, the first thing I do is pick some new parts to make it my own. But, you know, I'm going to spare all the other hot takes of the discussion for later on. And before we go into the chat with James, just want to clear out some housekeeping items. If you don't want to miss out on any of the upcoming episodes, which there will be quite a few, you can subscribe to the Skids and Giggles podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and of course, all the other platforms where you can find good podcasts. We also have an Instagram account under Skids and Giggles where you can follow along or get in touch. Otherwise, you could just find us and all the episodes and some more details on the episodes on our website under skidsandgiggles.com. So now, with all of that said and out of the way, let's just jump right into the chat with James. Today we sit down with James Drew. James runs Bike the World, a distribution company catering to the Swiss market. But I'm sure if you ask nicely and do a secret handshake, he will also cater to other markets. Bike the World represents some of the most illustrious brands in mountain biking today, and I'm sure we'll be talking a lot about some of them later on. James, thank you very much for sitting down with us and taking the time to talk. How's it going today?
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, all good. All good.
Cool. I'm also joined by my co-host, Bryson. Bryson, how's things with you?
Things are going great, Pascal. Hey, James.
As we've been preparing for this conversation and started comparing our notes, we realized that we just had too much material and content that we wanted to cover. So we've decided to split it into more digestible pieces. This is part one, where we talk about what it means to run a business in the bike industry in 2021. And James, why don't we start the discussion, the conversation with the executive summary? So basically, listener can tune out later. Mm-hmm. So can you lay out for us in basic steps what it takes to make $1 million? No, let's think big. What does it take to make $1 billion in the bike industry?
Oh, that's quite an easy question to answer, Pascal. You need to start with 2 billion.
Oh, and why is that?
Well, you know, biking's a hobby. I mean, it costs money, and you just sort of, you start with a lot and buy a lot of stuff, and then you don't really want to sell it to anyone. You want to keep it. So it's pretty much how it works.
Well, thank you very much for clearing that up for us. And, with all that said and done, let's hope we can shed a bit more light on what it really means and what it really takes.
For sure.
So maybe we should start the conversation with how has 2020 gone for you? I mean, 2020 has been a special year for everyone in the industry, pretty much for every group, be it as a user, as a rider, as a bike shop, as a distribution business, as an event company, as a guiding company, etc. How has it been going for you? And I guess what are the highlights?
Well, 2020 has been absolutely fantastic. We're quite lucky in the industry at the moment because there's a lot of other industries who are suffering with the current situation and the coronavirus, of course. When we went into lockdown in Switzerland, which was last March, I did get quite concerned. And then we found out about a week later that bike shops could stay open to service. bicycles, as bicycles are a means of transport. So they were available. They weren't allowed to open their shop floors, but they were allowed to service and they were allowed to sell. And having a lot of people that really didn't have much to do, you couldn't go and see your friends, you can't meet people, you can't go out to a bar or do anything like that, a lot of people turned to sports and a lot of people turned to biking. So, of course, our sales skyrocketed pretty much. And you can see that through the whole industry. So 2020 was a good year from a business perspective. Maybe personally, it was more difficult with the current situation. But I think anyone who works in the bike industry is feeling pretty lucky right now.
I would think so. And I mean, what I find interesting is that there's many facets to, you know, this bike boom or like the increase in bike participation in 2020, and obviously also today. Is on the one hand, more people that already had bikes, they use their bikes more and they were doing a lot more activities. But the other side of that is that you have a lot more new participants, so people that buy their first bikes or, you know, have been not riding for a long time and are only getting back into it. So what does that mean for, your business, which pretty much caters to, let's say, a more hardcore crowd or more boutique crowd? How does that translate?
When I look back, we sold a lot of wheel sets, actually, which I found very interesting. A lot more wheel sets than we used to. And I think there are a lot of people out there. So if we talk about existing customers, or shall we say someone who already has a bike, I think they went out riding and they were probably riding a lot, and then they probably realized quite quickly that maybe they needed something new or something better. And they had the time, or maybe it was someone who didn't ride that much and started riding a lot. And of course they got really back into it, because there was nothing else to do apart from ride your bike.
It's not a bad thing in my book. No.
So I definitely think, a lot of people got really back into it, and a lot of people probably, because we offer very high end parts for customizing pretty much. So I think a lot of people started to look at that. Hey, what can I do to make my existing bike better? Or even, you know, maybe they bought a new one and built it up, and maybe they wanted to invest in something a bit more special than an off the shelf bike, because they were spending more time on it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that, that makes a lot of sense. But I mean, in terms of, if you think about the newer riders, have you seen any, you know, let's say any, does that come through to you already, or is that still a little bit too far away from the, let's say, the upgrading market?
It's hard to say, actually. It's not something I ask my customers normally. I don't see many customers face to face either. So that's a difficult question to answer, actually. One thing I can tell you, where I live, there's a quite a popular road biking route. And it was quite interesting because we started to notice there was more bike traffic than there was actual traffic down this route. And what really stood out is the amount of women riding. Actually, that seemed to, I would say, go up 200% or something. I was really quite surprised to see, how many girls were out. So I'm guessing probably one of the larger consumer groups who went out and bought new bikes or got into biking was women at that time.
Okay, well, that's interesting. It obviously is one of the one of the topics that are relatively close to both Bryson and my heart. So, because certainly for myself, I would like to inspire my better half to be a bit more a bit more active on the biking side. But I'm still trying to unlock the secret to get her out on bikes more. And it's obviously something we want to explore with this project.
Really? I don't want mine riding with me. I quite enjoy the alone time.
Oh, well, it's different people, different
I'm just kidding. Right? I'm just kidding. Yeah. If she's listening, I'm just joking, my dear.
Absolutely. I think maybe a final point on this and the highlights in 2020 is, obviously something we also want to explore a little bit is kind of... what makes the Swiss bike market special, and if you have any data points or evidence in terms of how this bike boom is different here in Switzerland, particularly in Zurich where we live, versus maybe other markets, you have some intel on.
Well, the Swiss market's quite interesting because, I have worked in the European market as well. And I think what drives the Swiss customer is quality, high-end, exclusivity, these sort of things. And I seem to realize, not all the time, but price isn't always a big factor. So I've noticed here, people like to buy the best of whatever they're getting. So I've worked in the European market as well, and there things are really heavily price based. So there's a lot of customers out there who really think and buy according to price or try and get the best deal they can. Here, I think it's a lot more about getting something that will last a long time, is really good quality, and service is a big point as well. I think there's a large part of Swiss consumers also want to make sure if something goes wrong, they can talk to someone about it, or they can go by and get something fixed. I don't think they're that keen to just buy something. People do buy things offline, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of people who buy stuff offline. But I think there's a large portion of people, especially if it comes to more expensive things like bikes or wheel sets, mm-hmm. who are more willing to actually have that service contact and have that opportunity to go and talk to someone if they need to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a fair... fair ask on let's say I'm talking as a consumer here. I mean, if let's say you spend $3,000 on top of the shelf wheel set, and then on one of your first three rides it starts falling apart, then I don't want to be on the phone with a company in the US or in Far East and trying to figure out my $3,000 wheel set. And I think there is also a lot of value in that service function, the local service function, and on the one hand, and on the other hand also to set yourself apart as a brand versus something from a online discounter, which obviously in Europe is very, very common.
Well, you can put it in perspective if you look at cars, actually. You're not going to buy a $50,000 car and have it delivered to your front door online. You're going to want to go and see it, maybe sit in it, maybe take it for a test ride, maybe talk to someone about it. So, I think the higher the price goes, the more willing customers are to go into shops and really have that contact person.
One of the things I've noticed as a foreigner coming into Switzerland is the consumers are very aware that they have a good warranty to back everything they purchase normally. And that's something I didn't necessarily find in Canada. Mm-hmm. This awareness and this reliability. So it also drives part of the consumerism here.
I completely agree with that. I think Yeah, I think, I mean, that's kind of, I'd see that as service as well, like warranty, you know, that kind of backup if you need it. I think that's very important here. I mean, you, the other factor is, I mean, Switzerland is not a poor country. It's financially very stable, and there's a lot of people here who are also very financially stable as well. So I think that also plays a big factor into what kind of products you can sell here.
Absolutely agree. Maybe, you know, looking forward, I mean, obviously 2020 has been very special in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. What are your key, let's say, your key learnings or your key takeaways for 2021? You know, in terms of, you know, how are you positioning your business, or what are the key challenges this year to, you know, to be to be successful?
I had a big decision to make at the beginning of last year, and that was whether to sell direct as well as just distribute. Before, I was pretty much purely a distributor. And, you know, with the unsure situation, we did go online. We don't offer everything online. There's certain things that we don't. But I think it's something everyone's doing anyway. And of course, I don't want to annoy my customers. But the big reasoning behind it is, if someone's going to buy something online, they're going to do it anyway. So it makes more sense if they can buy it from me, and, you know, we can keep the money in Switzerland, and I can use it to prop up my business, rather than people buying abroad and, you know, the money not staying in Switzerland. So I think online was a big decision I had to make, and we went through that. And it's been quite interesting, because it's allowed me to also get a bit closer to the end consumer as well. So, you know, if someone's talking to me and they are unsure, I'm quite happy to also send them to one of my shops to say, hey, look, go and talk to these guys. You can go and see them face to face. Maybe they have the products in stock, and you know, you can get a bit of a better idea of maybe what you need or what you want. So I think the online was a big thing. I think if it comes to challenges, that wasn't so bad last year, but it's started to get worse by the end of the year, and is getting quite bad now, and that's delivery times. So with this huge boom, everyone sold everything, off it went, and now everyone's scrambling to get things produced. Of course, you know, the factories are struggling to cope with demand. I think we were chatting yesterday about that, Pascal. Apparently, they're also having issues to get workers.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that's
exactly, with the current
lockdowns of different shades and you know, social distancing, etc. I mean, that means, you know, the amount of people that you have on the floor space is, for example, is very limited. I know a friend of mine who works in the logistics business, and that's here in Switzerland, and that's one of their key bottlenecks is to actually get people into the logistics centers to. Or the amount of people into the logistics centers to actually fulfill, you know, the requirements.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's definitely going to be an interesting one. And I've worked in the bike industry for quite a long time, and forecasting is a very interesting subject. I've noticed the trend set tends to be you don't have much stock, but you sell loads of stuff, or you have a lot of interest. So then not all companies, but some companies will then order like crazy and end up with a huge amount of stock, which they probably will have to dump the next year. So I've seen this happen a few times. I'm not going to say everyone's like that. I work with one brand, and they seem to constantly order less than what they need, and of course that helps them keep the demand very high. Yeah. Where am I going with this? the main point is, I've forgotten.
Well, that happens. That happens.
It does. What were you talking about?
We're talking about ordering. We're talking about delivery times. And,
yeah, exactly. So one way I have found of combating this issue is I've started to take brands or started to work with brands who are manufacturing their products at home or by themselves. So they'll have a CNC machine or a factory or whatever, and they're just manufacturing on site. And that's quite interesting. First of all, the lead times are a lot less. Of course, this won't suit someone who's looking to mass produce something. But for high-end boutique products, it's perfect. And there's a huge amount of advantages. So first of all, lead times are less. If they don't have anything, you order it and they just make it. So you may be waiting at the most 8 weeks. Yeah. But it's normally a bit less. Another huge advantage is if they need to change something, they can just change it. So it allows companies to react way quicker. You know, make changes or do new things or do limited edition and that kind of stuff, as opposed from, you know, ordering in bulk from China. Then you have your products. If you find out it's wrong or something's not good, you know, you're kind of stuck with it. I mean, yeah, I think normally people send it back, but that's all your products going back. And you might not see it again for 6 months. It's not only expensive. The big problem is if you don't have anything, you can't sell anything and you won't make any money.
Yeah. Well, the core
pretty
of the
simple.
Problem also, I mean, again, you know, I mean, that's the core challenges of supply chain, and as you described before, right? So, I mean, the reason why people are not holding huge stock is because they need to fund that stock, right? So, and depending on how demand peters out in the end, that means they're either, you know, out of pocket and funding cost for that stock, or, you know, or they even make a loss, right? So, and that, because they can't sell it at the price that they've taken it in.
Exactly.
I think you're going on to an interesting tangent here, and this that I want to explore a little bit more is the, you know, the opportunity for smaller brands for, you know, currently for this year and maybe also the years to come is, you know, the onshore or at least nearshore production and owning your own production facilities. Uh-huh. The main problem with producing in the Far East is that most of the time you're hiring capacity from a bigger factory. Mm-hmm. Depending on the volume that you're ordering, you're, you know, first in line if you're one of the top three brands, mm-hmm. or probably more towards the bottom of the pile if you're a small brand. And
depends how big your wallet is, I think. Yeah,
exactly, that too. And you know, how big your client entertainment budget. But obviously, the other end of the spectrum is obviously local production, own production, in-house production. Mm-hmm. That obviously also has its own cost challenges, and obviously Switzerland being, let's say, a high-cost production company, not only because of, you know, the cost of human capital is pretty high here, but on the other hand, we have the benefit of having very specialized, you know, engineering and machining skills here on the ground. So my take on this is that there is somewhere a sweet spot between, you know, being big enough to justify the cost to do your own production, either in your own facilities or, you know, in a somewhat remote facility, or you know, producing it on shore, like right in your own facilities, in the local market, and producing for the local market directly.
I mean, it's an interesting one. I mean, manufacturing over here, I'm not sure if Switzerland will be that much more expensive than doing it in the US, for example. There's probably some European countries which would be probably cheaper if you look at the East Bloc. I think Portugal's quite reasonable as well. But the costs will always be higher when you make stuff here. But you have, there's a lot more benefits. And I think mainly it's the speed. So I think you can increase sales quite easily. If you have a good product and you have high demand for that product, I think you can just turn around manufacturing much quicker. Although don't quote me on that. I don't have any statistical proof to back that comment up, but it's more of a gut feeling. We're going to start working with an English company in a couple of weeks. Well, we already are. We already fulfilled the order. And what he's doing is quite interesting. So he makes pedals. Company is called Pembry. Phil Law is his name. He's a great guy. He has a CNC machine, and he's focusing just on, he's got two pedals, so he's not going nuts with a huge product lineup. He's got two products, which he's focusing on, and the margins, they will be smaller because, of course, it's more expensive to produce stuff in Europe. But the other things he's doing is really quite interesting as well. So his company is 100% carbon neutral. So he's for every pedal he makes, he plants a tree. So England's going to be a forest soon,
I think. there's a number of brands that do that, right?
Yeah, but it's a really interesting aspect because speaking to him, he's like, yeah, he can really control his whole supply chain. And he can also do something that makes a difference. And he can also manufacture quickly. And he was the one that also told me, the greatest thing is if I need to change something, I just do it and then run out the next batch.
It's a change of the code, basically, if you have a CNC machine.
Yeah, exactly. So I think people will have to get used to less margin the more people who start to bring manufacturing back home. I think that will change the margins, but I do anticipate that sales will grow. I think availability is the big issue at the moment, deliverability and availability, and I think that's going to be the factor that changes. So, I mean, the more you sell, the better, even if you are getting less. It should be interesting. I do also think these smaller brands who are doing this are going to be more successful in the future, because I think they're just going to be the ones who are there. And if they grow, of course, they will start making other products. They will probably find ways of doing things cheaper or increasing their volume, that kind of thing. I know he's already invested in quite a bit of equipment, so he can machine, I think, 8 pedals at once as opposed to one. These are the type of things, I think, especially with something like this, I think people will probably invest more in technology to try and speed the processes up a bit. So I think it's a good starting point for a lot of companies, and I think they'll be able to work on that. And I'm a big fan of having things made locally, and I think a lot of people probably are becoming more inclined that way, shall we say. I think it's also, the whole conscious feeling of what's going on. The environment is a big impact. I mean, we all like to go and ride our bikes outside in the nature. We don't want to go and we don't want to go outside if it's more unhealthy to be out there than it is inside.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I think it's a good thing, and it's something we're really looking for, or I'm looking for at the moment when I look for a new brand is are they making their stuff themselves, you know?
So basically what you're saying is that we should be exploring the possibilities of local manufacture down at the industrial estate from your old address.
Yeah, well, why not? I have actually in the past, I have spoken to CNC, machining companies in Switzerland. It's quite expensive to, for example, I asked one company if they could produce a stem for me, just sort of hypothetically, because I was interested. And he said, yeah, it would cost about $4,000 to make that. But of course, he then said, but that's just to make one. If you make 4,000, it's going to cost like $5,000, you know.
Yeah.
So, it's all about volume. So, it's probably a big investment. I mean, if someone has to design it, and I don't think machining it's the problem. I think it's more designing, programming the machine, which will be expensive here.
Absolutely.
But, if you look at Pembry, he has his own CNC machine. So,
yeah,
although
absolutely.
That was a lot more than $4,000, I'm sure.
True, but I think this theme of local production, as you say, that's not going away. And I believe that companies, to name names like Pohl or Atherton Bikes, for example, with their technology, uh-huh. they have an opportunity to make that reproducible.
Uh-huh.
Onshore, basically. So I don't really see why, for example, if you pull stamina, why that needs to be produced in Finland. Mm. I mean, basically, they can just send you the codes for the CNC machine. You could buy your aluminum. You can buy that locally and stick the code into the machine and have your stamina produced, right next door.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I'm not sure if it's that simple.
I don't know. I'm not an engineer. I mean, that's why I have Bryson as my sidekick.
We need to have an in-house engineer here.
But take Atherton Bikes, right? So the flip side to that is obviously 3D printing. If you have the infrastructure to do the printing, then in theory, the hurdle to local production is relatively low.
I have to say that's quite an interesting idea. If you think about it, rather than if you could, so I'm sure there's that kind of opportunity in most, shall we say, European countries to get things machined. That's quite an interesting idea, actually, rather than making everything yourself, actually sending it to someone who could have actually make something locally. You'll be saving on delivery costs or shipping costs.
Absolutely.
It's better for the environment. So you're not sending stuff around. It's quite an interesting concept, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the trade-off is obviously one of quality assurance, the warranty chain, let's say. And balancing that off versus producing it where your local market is, right? So, can you let's say take Pohl? Can you ensure that the stamina that's produced here in Zurich that is of the same quality than the one that is produced in Finland?
Mm.
And what does that mean for your warranty? So I think that's some of the hurdles that I would be exploring before I invested my hard-earned money into a remote production bike company. Although, as you say, the notion of it is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think having the right equipment as well is probably quite a big factor as well, because I'm sure I know a lot of these machine products do have specific, correct me if I'm wrong, Bryson, but I think you do need specific equipment to do specific things.
You do need to make sure you have the correct tooling. That's correct.
that's good that a sales guy and a finance dude are talking about engineering problems while the engineer is just sitting nodding his head.
You guys are on point. I'll fill in.
Okay, good. Glad you agreed, Bryson.
I'll tell you what, one thing that's not easy to make and will probably continue to be made in China or Taiwan is aluminium handlebars. So you need quite specific, they're hydroformed. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, Bryson. But yeah, you need it's possible to buy the tools to do that, of course, but... one of my brands did look into doing that at home, and they said they couldn't find anyone who had the technology to actually do it. They were kind of stuck when it came to that.
I guess there's parts and components of a bike that lend themselves to being produced let's say a more remote way, and then others that are not, because they have a concentration of technology and know-how, basically. We've already been talking about a few names, a few brands. Maybe we just can close out that point of the discussion with who do you think does a great job in the current environment, and others that have some homework to do.
If I talk about my brands, for example, I must say Industry 9 is completely on point. They make everything themselves in North Carolina. I do know they also had to invest in a whole load of new machines because production went up. Their marketing's on point. The whole custom, they are purely custom. You can get cheaper wheel sets from them, actually, which we sell quite well too. But their marketing is on point. Their name is on point. The quality of their product is absolutely amazing, and they're spot on. They have pretty much every standard your little heart desires. I think the customization is a big drive there as well. Actually, I think that gets people in the door. However, I find a lot of people tend to tone down their original designs end up having all black in the end.
Because black is fast.
From 11, as we know. Yeah, exactly. After going from 11 colors to, I just have a black one. Can't make up my mind. But I have to say what they're doing, I find is absolutely fantastic, spectacular. Okay. And I think in the last 2 years they probably have grown quite substantially, actually.
Absolutely. But again, I know personally, because I have one, they offer obviously a billion different customization options. But what is your feeling on what is the most, apart from black and black, what is the most common color combination?
The most,
Are they making or losing money on the customization part?
I think they're making money. Now, Industry 9 I have to say, no, we do sell quite a lot of colors. For example, with Cro-Mag, I noticed people tend to take black.
It's fast.
Yeah, exactly. I just think so. Purple is hugely popular right now. Silver is very popular, and turquoise.
That's the local Yeti crowd.
Yeah. So I mean, I've worked with I've worked with Cro-Mag now for 12 years, and they do loads of colors, and that's quite interesting, because you can see the color trend is, and it makes sense, really is really based on the new bikes, so the coming bikes for the next season. And I do use that to help me forecast, so I will go and look at maybe some of the bigger brands, you know, Trek or Transition, Yeti, you know, all of those kind of guys, see what kind of colorways they're doing. And that allows me to, you know, predict, okay, what colors am I going to sell?
Yeah. Okay. Then maybe kind of to finish up the discussion, there's a final point I want to cover is, you know, what trends that you have observed over the last, let's let it be 6 months or so, which one of those do you think are a bit transient, so they will go away relatively soon? And which ones do you think will stick around?
Trends as in product?
You know, changes, or what has, you know, stuff that has already, you know, accelerated a transition process, you know,
so
the way we do business, production. I mean, we've covered a lot about, you know, the production and how we think this is going to shift towards more local production.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe what are the other trends that you've observed that
Probably the biggest one I've seen is, and this started before Corona actually, is custom builds. I think there's a lot more people. I think even guys who are even looking to buy their first bike are considering, you know, customization, changing bits. I mean, one issue with customization is it's always going to be more expensive than buying something off the shelf. And I know a lot of companies are trying to do the best they can when they sell, you know, a complete bike off the shelf, you know, make sure they have a 35 millimeter handlebar clamp size. And all this kind of stuff, you know, I think they're trying to go with the trends. But I think a lot of people out there just want to add that personal touch. You know, they don't want to have the exact same bike as the neighbor does. You know, they want to have something else on there. And it allows consumers, you know, to talk about it. You know, it's a bit of a talking point. You know, I mean, anyone who's into biking, especially if we look at enduro or dirt or downhill or mountain biking in general, you know,
just mountain biking basically.
Yeah, mountain biking. I think that's one of the great things about it. You go out and you do check out your buddy's ride, and hey, what have you got on there? Hey, have you done something new? And I think also this aspect of, shall we call it tuning, almost, you know, making these little changes, these upgrades to improve your ride or even just improve the look of your bike is a big thing. And I think it's become a lot bigger over the past 2 years. I think that's probably has a lot to do with marketing. So especially social media, there's people out there posting these great builds, which, you know, of course, encourages and any consumer, you know, to have a look. And it might not encourage them to buy that bike specific or build something like that, but it will encourage them maybe to go out and build something that kind of has their own, you know, stamp on it, their own take. So I think that's a trend that's going, is going to continue to climb. And I think another trend is, that's based on customization as well, but people are spending more money. That's the feeling I get when I talk to bike shops. They seem to say, yeah, it's either or, you know, there seems to be no middle ground. It's either, yeah, I want an enduro bike, but I want to, you know, to be as cheap as possible. Maybe because they don't have that much fluid liquidity available. Mm. And then on the other hand, there's people going in and, yeah, I want the best, you know, here's my Amex. hit me up.
An interesting observation, because I mean that's certainly something I have observed. Obviously, I've been riding bikes for a very long time, and I don't make a secret out of it that I ride bikes, be it in social circles or at work. And of course, people ask me whenever they get into riding bikes, it's like, hey, look, I want to get into bikes. I want to buy a bike. Do you have a recommendation? So let's say I want to buy a road bike, and then and I say like, okay, look, you know, normally I would recommend someone that starts, let's go in at a 105 Shimano level. So kind of that kind of price point around, what is that? But maybe between 2,000 and 3,000 francs or something like that. And the tolerance and acceptance of like the higher entry price has increased dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years, I would say. Whereas if you said 10 years ago, if you said like, well, you want to get into road biking, that's going to set you back 2,000 francs for an entry level bike. Mm. They would have been like, oh, really? Maybe I should consider something else. Mm-hmm. And today they're like, oh, wow. I thought I need to spend like 5,000 to 6,000 francs to get a decent bike. What am I going to do with the rest? And I was like, well, so you've been drinking the Kool-Aid and think that you really need a 6,000 franc bike to get started in riding a bike. And that saved you just saved you a lot of money, or you can buy two bikes for the
same price.
Well, I think
spend it on a great trip, spend it on some coaching, spending on a guide, something like that.
I think people's, I think their education has maybe changed. I mean, when I first started mountain biking a long time ago, I was also surprised by the price. I mean, this was when I was in my early 20s and I wanted to go and buy a bike. And I was like, you know, I didn't have loads of cash back then.
Unlike now, of course.
Yeah, I have 1 billion Swiss francs now. But I started with 2. But, I was surprised back then as well. And it's not until you kind of, you get into it and you realize actually it's a complex piece of kit. You know, it's got a lot of moving parts. If you want hydraulic disc brakes, that's they aren't cheap. And there's all these factors, and I think people are just a bit more educated, and I think they just kind of know now, okay, if I want a decent bike to, shall we say, do sports, whether it's road biking, mountain biking, enduro, downhill, whatever, triathlon. I think people know they're going to have to spend, you know, like 5 grand probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a rule, and I always say this to everyone, because I, you know, in my social circle, there's a lot of people who don't bike and don't know anything about bikes. And I always say, as a rule, I mean, even if you're just buying a simple city bike, you shouldn't go below 1,000 francs. Of course, you can get stuff, good quality stuff, for less than that. But I always say, you know, set that as kind of the benchmark and then go and have a look and see what's out there. But I don't go in thinking you're going to get a brand new bike for, you know, 50 bucks, you know, because you're going to come back very disappointed. Just the knowledge has just changed. I think people know what to expect if they're going to get a bike.
Okay. And maybe last point on the customization. I mean, what kind of what are the main items that people upgrade first? Are they going straight for the sweet carbon fiber rims, or are they going for just a cool new title bar?
Well, I can only talk for myself here, because I do wheels, components, so handlebars, pedals, stems, saddles, all of that kind of stuff. So last year, wheels was big, very big. However, wheels are expensive. When it came to turnover, wheels would probably be the biggest. But if we look at
numbers,
items sold, pedals is very big. I say pedals, handlebar, stem. That's if I look at my orders, that's most of them are, it's either handlebar, stem, saddle or handlebar, stem, pedals.
Which makes sense. I mean, some of the stuff that you have most contact with on the mm-hmm. one hand, so your feet, hopefully you have your feet on the pedals most of the time, unless you're a slope styler, then hopefully you don't. and obviously a stem and a handlebar you have in front of your face pretty much at all times. So, I mean, that, you know, the human is a predictable animal, I would say.
mm-hmm. Yes, they are. I mean, yeah, I mean, if you just go items sold, it's, I'd say handlebars are the most popular, actually.
Okay. I guess that, you know, brings us towards the end of the of our conversation for part one. Do you have any other points that you would like to make, James?
Many. How many hours you got?
Well, the good news is that we have planned so many more parts. but that's obviously only part one. And we'll see how we go with that one. And then next week we do part two.
Oh, all right. No, it's good.
Bryson, is there anything else you would like to add?
Yeah, I just want our listeners to know that they should really tune in for the next parts in our series, because we dive into, it's a multifaceted series that we're doing. We're touching on all the different aspects. So I think it's quite exciting.
What do we have planned for part two, Bryson?
One of the things I'm looking forward to is talking about marketing, because mountain biking is a marketing animal. Mm-hmm. And I feel it plays a larger role.
And we know that James feels very passionately about marketing, and especially social media. Mm-hmm. So we'll dedicate an entire episode to marketing and social media and how you can make an impression in 2021. Because obviously that, you know, the business has its hurdles, but if the world has changed for anyone, then it's definitely for athletes, for pro riders, and for anyone that tries to make an impression in this market. Maybe as a final point, James, if listeners want to find more about James Drew and his business, where can they follow you?
Actually, I only accept messages sent by pigeon.
So, oh, sweet. Do you have a special breed that you use, or you're
that's a secret.
You're an equal opportunity pigeon recipient.
Exactly. So no, you can find anything. If you have any questions about me or the brands that I distribute, the web address is biketheworld.ch. Feel free to go on and have a look. Any questions, just hit the contact button. Of course, you can find our social media pretty easily from the page as well.
Sweet. Well, thank you very much for taking the time, James, and I'm sure we'll talk soon again.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
See you, James.